It's the 10th of August, 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about curious things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Is NASA Mars curious, and has it told its parents yet? Does the Coalition's initial closeness leave some Lib Dems wondering if they've got some boundaries to review? Was being a suffragette hard work, or was it all just horsing around? And why is the Olympics causing so many conspiracy theories? And is this just a precursor to Bilderberg 2016? But first, the awkward begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please head over to our website and subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and really do help us keep doing what we do week after week. Go on, it's like buying us a couple of drinks a month. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, we start the show this week with the obvious big news of the week, that humanity has somehow managed to make a massive robot land on the away-facing side of another planet and then send its holiday photos back. I am, of course, talking about Curiosity, the Mars rover that NASA landed there this week. Or so they claim. Given that we've only seen grainy photos so far, don't be surprised if it turns out that there was a Loch Ness monster on a grassy knoll near to Gale Crater where the rover landed. To find out more, though, Liz Luckendorf has been speaking to, get this, the deputy project scientist on Curiosity, Joy Crisp. Apologies in advance for the slightly poor-sounding audio quality. Liz and I are on holiday this week, so we recorded this on a rather ropey hotel internet connection. Liz started by asking her to explain exactly what it is that the deputy project scientist actually does.
Sure. So we actually have two deputy project scientists on this mission because it's so big and there's so much work to get done. And both of us assist the project scientist, who's John Grotzinger. He's a Caltech professor who's the lead scientist on the mission. He is responsible for ensuring that we get the best science return from this mission within the constraints that we have. So he relies on the two deputies, me and Ashwin Vasavada, to do a lot of additional support for him to accomplish that. So he, one of the main things that he focuses on is the strategic leadership for the science team and building a consensus among the 9 different instrument principal investigators. To give you an example of some of the things that I've worked on over the years to get ready for landing, we're planning and leading operations tests for the science team to practice what we are now doing today. I also was involved in setting up training for them so they could learn how to use the software tools and figure out how to follow procedures. And I've also been planning the archival of the instrument data sets that will begin about 6 months after landing, making the data from all the instruments available to the whole science community.
I guess one of the most interesting things was the video that came out about basically the 7 minutes of terror. Can you convey how difficult that is and why did it have to be done this way?
Basically, it was done like this because the systems that we had used for previous landings wasn't going to work for something this massive. So the rover weighs about a ton, and the airbags would just break if we tried that kind of design. They did consider prior approaches and whether they could modify them, make thicker airbags and things like that. And they also looked at new approaches. Like one of the kinds of approaches they looked at was putting the rover on a platform that you'd kind of cushion as it came in for an impact. But then you have the problem of you have this massive platform and it can be tilted if it lands on slopes or rocks. They just found problems with every system they could come up with until they looked at this sky crane type of system, which basically puts the platform on top of the rover rather than under it and lowers the rover gently on its own wheels and suspension to the ground. So it's not obvious to any of us, you know, you look at it and go, how did they come up with that? But they did it by looking at every possible way they could think of and deciding that this was the best and the easiest to implement.
How do you practice that sort of landing? Was it purely mathematical or were there actual tests? Because the atmospheres, you couldn't test it here, I guess, because the atmosphere is much thicker than Mars.
Right. So it's true that we could not do a full test because we would have to build the planet Mars for our test chamber. So it's really not possible. But you do a lot of math and physics to come up with models for the environmental conditions as best we know them, with the uncertainties that we know on those. And then you also have to have the physical models for the spacecraft and then run these models to see if it will land safely. But then you have to check those models. And they did that by running many different kinds of tests, many kinds of tests. I'll give you an example of a few. So the parachute was critical. So they tested the parachute part of entry, descent, and landing in a giant wind tunnel up at NASA Ames to make sure that it would open properly at high speed. So that was done kind of in a sideways, so the wind is blowing sideways, it's not coming down, you know, but they were able to test certain aspects of that parachute opening. They tested the radar sensor that told the spacecraft where the ground was by putting it on different aircraft and flying them around over ground at known elevations and seeing that it worked. So that's examples of the kinds of tests they did. It was quite extensive.
We all kind of know the answer to this, but maybe you can give us more nuance into it. How did it go? How did the launch go?
It went really well. So I think even surprising to us that everything has gone so well.
And were you surprised by the reaction? I was amazed that my entire Twitter feed was full of people up at 6:30 in the morning waiting for it to land. And there was shots of people in Times Square. Then there was the ridiculousness of the Tumblr for Mohawk guy, in quotation marks. Were you surprised by the massive amounts of attention?
Yes, I was surprised. I mean, I know that I myself and all my colleagues here, we're into it, but I didn't realize that the public would be so captivated by it so widely. Yeah, that surprised me.
The rover has been described as a robotic geologist, and it's a geology mission, not a life-detecting mission. Can you explain the reasoning behind that? Why is it primarily a geology mission?
Well, at this point, we actually still don't know how to design a life detection mission. We did try to do that with the Viking missions in the 1970s, and we learned how hard that is to do. And so the science community decided to take the next step towards that by doing a thorough characterization of the environment, the past and present environment. And to answer the question, are there environments, past or present, that are favorable for life and favorable for preserving evidence of life?
Could the rover actually detect life then, or is it only going to detect these conditions or possible conditions?
Yeah, it's not really set up to detect life. So we can look for the building blocks of life with the organic analysis instrument called SAM. As you said, it'll look primarily at environments, looking at the geology, chemistry, mineralogy, and radiation, and assess whether the areas we're visiting were ever habitable.
As mentioned previously, people are obviously excited about this mission. Do you have to calm a lot of expectations on whether there's going to be life? Or I guess the other one is like, is this paving the way for a manned mission to Mars?
Yeah, I mean, well, we want people to be excited about the mission. So, and we are taking steps towards those things, which, you know, towards a manned mission and towards finding life. So we do want to keep the excitement going. But we do want to make sure people realize, you know, the manned mission isn't coming in 10 years and we're not likely to find life in this mission because we didn't design the mission to do that. But for instance, for manned missions, we brought this instrument called the radiation assessment detector that measures the broad spectrum of high energy radiation at the surface of Mars. And this has never been done before, and it will instruct engineers who are planning human missions about what the radiation levels are like, what the future astronauts might be exposed to, and could help them engineer the right level of shielding. So that is a significant step that will be helpful for future human missions. Yeah, we're always tempering the folks that say, oh, so you're going to look for life. And then we have to say, well, not exactly, but we are taking a big step forward towards that by looking at the environment.
Curiosity landed in the Gale Crater. Can you explain why this location was chosen and what are you hoping to find in the Gale Crater or in the environment in the coming weeks and months?
Well, this location was chosen after careful study for many years and several meetings with open to a wide number of scientists where they would argue about the best scientific location and the best safe location to send the rover to. And they came up with Gale Crater, where they believe that there's a very thick stack of layered rocks in this mountain in the middle of Gale Crater that preserves a long record of changing environmental conditions. They believe this based on orbital data that shows signs that there are clay minerals towards the bottom and sulfate minerals higher up. That's an indicator that it might be that there was a lot more water around in earlier times on Mars, locked in those lower layers, and that the newer rocks that are piled up higher up are exhibiting evidence for a drier climate. So by driving the rover up this mountain, which we believe is possible because we can see the slopes from orbit, we could then get at the answer of how did those environments change, and is that truly the case?
How long is the initial the mission for Curiosity? How long is it guaranteed to last, or supposed to last for?
Yeah, it's like a warranty when you go to the store and buy something. The engineers designed it with a 2 Earth year mission lifetime. So they tested, purchased parts and tested them to make sure that they would last that long. Now, it might go longer than that if Spirit and Opportunity are any indication, but they just picked things, did their testing and chose parts to make sure that it should last for 2 Earth years.
How far will it travel in comparison to the other rovers?
Well, the answer to how far it will go is we really don't know, because it's going to be up to the science team to decide how far it wants to go, where it wants to go, how long it will stop at different places. The other side of that question might be, how far is it capable of going? And there again, the sort of warranty was that the engineers designed it to be able to go 20 kilometers at least. Again, it might be able to go longer than that. There's nothing that will break right at 20.1 kilometers, but it was designed so that we could at least get outside of our landing ellipse. So, you know, compared to Spirit, went about 7.7 kilometers, Opportunity is still driving, and it's gone 34.6 kilometers. So, but it was designed for 600 meters. So it's gone much further. So time will tell as to whether Curiosity can beat Opportunity's odometer.
And Curiosity is much bigger than the previous two rovers, and it's got lots of interesting things. What's the new science that's going to come out? What can you do differently than what was done previously with the other two rovers?
For new science, I'll touch on two things. One is totally new kinds of instrumentation. So in that category, you would have ChemCam, which can zap rocks and soils with a laser and from a distance of up to 7 meters. And tell us what the chemistry of the spot it analyzed is. So that's a whole new capability we've never had before, and we can use that to survey things that are in front of the rover. We can point it in all directions, and we can say, oh, let's drive over to that. Let's put the robotic arm down on that rock or that soil because it looks interesting. The totally new is drilling into rocks. We've never done that before. We can also scoop soil. We can analyze the atmosphere. The SAM instrument can receive powdered drill rock material. It can receive scoop soil and tell us what organic compounds are present, and also something about carbon isotopes and other isotopes. And then there's the CAM-IN instrument. Never brought an X-ray diffraction spectrometer to Mars before, and that will tell us what minerals are present in the rocks and soils. So that's all new. Now, we have another, I didn't also mention, the first time ever we're bringing a meteorology, a weather station, on a rover. And then we're going to sample what the winds and temperature and pressure are like at different locations as we drive around. We've got the radiation monitor and a hydrogen analyzer. All of that is new. Some things that you might say are not as new would be some of the cameras and the APXS, which is a chemical analyzer. But all of those are improved over past versions, significantly improved. And in addition to that, we're in a whole new location on Mars. So it's going to be all new science no matter what, because we're looking at totally different geologic materials with a different story to tell us about what the past was like on Mars. So it's all new.
Oh, brilliant. It's really going to be exciting for us sitting in the rest of the world waiting for all this stuff to come in. And one of those things is obviously going to be all these photos and that will come from the cameras, as you mentioned. There's a couple that have come now, and I think the lens cap or the protective covering is still on. When do those come off, and when do you get to share all these magnificent photos?
Well, we had covers on the hazard cameras that popped off right away, and so some of the very first pictures showed a view looking forwards from the rover, a couple feet off the ground, and looking rearwards. So, and we saw that with the dust cover on, there was a fair amount of dust on them. So it was good that we had those, and we popped those off, and they're one time only, so we'll never put those covers back on. Then we saw the MOLLE color image, and that one had the cover on, and it was a dusty scene, kind of blurry. That one has a cover that you can command to open and shut, and so during the mission, when we want to take a picture, we can command the cover to open. We're going to wait until we're sure the dust has settled around the area before we do that. Take the picture, and then we can cover it up again. What we're about to do is, well, we got two navigation camera images today that were full frame and some thumbnails. Those don't have a cover per se. So we had some pictures when it was first down on the deck, and now we've raised the mast. So we're looking out from the top of the mast now, starting to take those pictures. So soon we might be getting the mast cam color images that will start coming from the mast, and that would start with thumbnails. We might start seeing those tomorrow, and then could be the weekend or later when we start receiving full frame color images from the mast cam camera, and that should be really exciting. And then it'll take quite some time after that before we can stitch those together to make a good-looking panorama.
And I guess there's probably timelines and points where actually where other exciting things may happen. What should all of us outside NASA be waiting for and watch out for from Curiosity?
Well, you know, we don't really have a planned mission. We've planned the beginning, the very beginning, because we have all these checkouts to do. There's really not a specific schedule that I could tell you once we get over these initial checkouts, which will be the next week or so, because, you know, we're going to be reacting and deciding what to do in what order based on what we're learning from the images and the data sets.
Cool. Well, it'll be a lovely surprise for all of us then.
It's really a mission of exploration and discovery. And, you know, we end up reacting to what we see and learn. And then we decide on how to adjust the strategic plan, you know, our long-term vision of what we're trying to do. And then our tactical day-to-day rover activities follow from that.
Thank you very much for talking to us.
Staying with things on other planets now, and we move to Nick Clegg, who this week was still under the impression that he had some credibility left. Despite giving up on the one thing that sort of made the coalition worthwhile, reform of the House of Lords. So Clegg has decided to throw a bit of a strop, and is now trying to block attempts to change the boundaries of parliamentary constituencies in retaliation. I know what you're thinking, ooh, badass Clegg. With such a hard man attitude, no wonder the Tories only managed to destroy the NHS, hike tuition fees and let Toby Young run the school before Clegg put a stop to their fun. Oh well. Here's Corey Hazlehurst explaining why the boundary review is important.
David Cameron seems to have spent most of his week at the Olympics. But when he's not been there, he's been engaged in the latest coalition disagreement. Nick Clegg has announced the Lib Dems will vote against proposed boundary changes, which will be put to a vote in Parliament sometime before the next election in 2015. I'll therefore focus this week on why this disagreement over boundary changes is worth a closer inspection. Under our first-past-the-post system, the boundaries of each seat become very important. Perhaps the easiest way to explain why is to have a quick look at the Daily Mash website. It's got a spoof news story in which it says, and I quote, "Under David Cameron's proposed new boundaries, up north, which includes traditional Labour strongholds Manchester, Liverpool and Newcastle, will elect a single MP. Meanwhile, David Cameron's hometown of Chipping Norton will be split into 27 constituencies, three of them representing areas of Cameron's house. Under this very extreme example, the whole of the north of England would only have one MP compared to 27 in Chipping Norton, despite the north of England having probably about 20 million more people than Chipping Norton. Now, this is admittedly a very exaggerated example, but shows why the boundaries of Westminster seats are important. If they are distorted, they can lead to some places being over or underrepresented, and even mean that one political party has an unfair advantage over another. That's why getting the boundaries right is very important. To stop any overt cheating, there are independent boundary commissions for England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. They launched their sixth review of constituency boundaries in March last year and presented a draft consultation report in September 2011. Their final report is due by the 1st of October 2013. However, they'll make their recommendations on the basis of the Parliamentary Voting System and Constituencies Act 2011, in which the government set down the parameters of the commission. This act laid down two important conditions. First, that the number of MPs was to be reduced, and second, that each constituency should be about the same size, between roughly 72,000 and 80,000 constituents. Let's have a look at both of them in turn. So, both the Conservatives and the Lib Dems promised a reduction in the number of MPs in their manifestos. The Tories proposed a 10% cut, from 650 to 585 MPs, whilst the Lib Dems wanted an even bigger cut, down to 500 MPs. Instead, the 2011 Act fixed the number of MPs at 600. Reducing the number of MPs might at first seem like a sensible thing to do. It was argued by the government at the time that the 650 members of the House of Commons was far too many. To give a comparison, Congress in the United States has got 440 members, and the lower house in India has got 545 members. But there doesn't really seem to be any logic behind the change at all. David Heath, Deputy Leader of the House of Commons, admitted to Parliament that the change was an arbitrary one. Vernon Bogdanor, Britain's leading constitutional expert, calls this a perverse reaction to the expenses scandal. The electorate has increased by 30% since 1950, partly because of population growth, and partly because the franchise has been extended to people aged 18 to 21. In 1945, the average MP had a constituency of 66,000 people. Now it's 96,000, an increase of 30%. This means more work for less MPs to do. Then you have to take into account the fact that in 1945, people were less demanding of MPs, in what Bogdanor calls an age of deference. Usually, the MP was voted for every 4 or 5 years, and no effort was made to petition him in the interim. Sir Godfrey Collins, Secretary of State for Scotland from 1932 to 36, held 5 constituency surgeries in 30 years as an MP. Yes, you heard that right, just 5 in 30 years. Clement Attlee, former Labour Prime Minister, refused to hold surgeries at all because he thought his job was to deal with high matters of state rather than deal with local concerns. Such an attitude would be unthinkable now for an MP, and also seems to suggest that any cost saved in getting rid of 50 MP salaries would be more than made up for by the 600 MPs having to hire more assistants to help them deal with their increased amount of paperwork. Reducing the number of MPs to 600 is also a silly idea, because it means Parliament is less able to scrutinise the government. I've talked before in the Pod Delusion about how we've got too many ministers in Britain, about 120, which means there aren't enough talented backbenchers scrutinising government policy. If we got rid of 50 MPs, that shortage of backbench scrutinising talent becomes even worse. It's a knee-jerk response to the expenses scandal that won't make anything better and could make a few things even worse. Now let's move on to the second issue, that of boundary changes, which is in many ways the heart of the matter. Because the boundary changes proposed seem to help the Tories a little bit more than Labour, Labour have said that the proposals of the Commission amount to gerrymandering. That's a little bit simplistic, though. For a start, it ignores the fact that current boundaries are massively skewed in favour of Labour. That's why in 1992, John Major received a small majority of 22 seats with a 7.5% lead over Labour. And yet in 2005, Labour got a quite commanding majority of 66 with only a 3% lead. Also, any change to the boundaries will inevitably benefit the Conservatives over Labour, because most population movement is from the Labour-supporting inner cities to the generally Conservative-supporting rural areas. So at the moment, it takes less votes to elect a Labour MP than it does a Conservative MP. There's nothing wrong with equal constituency sizes. It was one of the main demands of the Chartists 2 centuries ago. It also stops absurdities such as the Daily Mash-style gerrymandering that I talked about earlier. But this boundary review is based on the current electoral roll, which misses off 10% of people who are able to vote but aren't registered. It surely makes more sense to draw up constituency boundaries using the far more accurate 2011 census data. Also, enforcing such a strict limit on constituency size has meant the boundary review has to come up with some illogical boundaries. One of these is the creation of the so-called Devon Wall constituency, or Bude and Bideford, which incorporates parts of Devon and Cornwall into the constituency. This has caused much consternation in Cornwall, with one Cornish independence campaigner threatening to hold a hunger strike over the issue. There are many more examples of seats being shoehorned together from different wards or local authorities, without any respect for the local communities which the MPs are supposed to be representing. Stephen Brooks, director of the ERS for Wales, described the process of this review as being, and I quote, "a vision of equality where the maths matters but our communities don't." There are still many hurdles to overcome before a vote on the boundaries is put to Parliament, and without Lib Dem support, it's very unlikely these changes can go through anyway. I haven't talked about the political motives of the Lib Dems' decision, mainly because that's less important than the details of the review itself, but you can rest assured we're going to have a bit of a rollercoaster the next few months for the Coalition. This was Corey Hazelhurst for the Pod Delusion.
Now on to the so-called Olympics, which is actually nothing but a false flag operation by the Illuminati to hide the fact that the royal family are lizards and Princess Diana is actually alive, a time traveller, and on the moon, which is why they had to fake it in 1969. Or something like that anyway. This week, Blakely Nixon has been checking out some of the more bizarre Olympic claims made by members of the conspiracy theory community. And of course, if there are any conspiracy theorists listening, then they'll know that this segment is just a false flag operation to discredit their actually accurate conspiracy theories and make them sound a bit silly. And also, if there are any conspiracy theorists listening, then they'll know that we're listening to them too. Here's Blakely Nixon with more.
So it seems that most people in the country have positively embraced the London 2012 Olympics. Even some of the anti-sport, anti-competition, and anti-exercise listeners to the Pod Delusion seem to have enjoyed the last 2 weeks. I've even caught James O'Malley watching the swimming. But there is a small minority of people not focusing on the sport during the Games. For them, the Olympics are not about faster, higher, stronger, but about the New World Order, virgin sacrifices, and false flag alien invasions. That's right, we're talking conspiracy theorists. And if we are to believe these people, the opening ceremony was a subliminal satanic ceremony full of Freemason symbology, I think they mean symbolism, and as the eyes of the world are focused on London this Sunday for the closing ceremony, the New World Order will use the best visual effects designers from Hollywood, which of course they control, to fake an alien invasion. And they will use this fake alien invasion as an excuse to enact a global coup, remove all our civil liberties, and set up a one-world government and global religion. You know, the thing they've been planning for the last 2,000 years. So we Pod Delusioners are a sceptical bunch, and I'm sure at this point you're all picking holes in this alleged plan. But fear not, sceptics. There is evidence. And when I say evidence, I mean a series of unrelated events, facts, claims that can in a way be regarded as evidence by anybody with a logical mind. Some of this evidence includes the fact that the London 2012 logo can be jumbled up to spell the word Zion, the fact that William Blake, an alleged Freemason, wrote the words to the song Jerusalem, a song which talks about building a new Jerusalem in England, and this is apparently full of all Freemasonry stuff. The Olympic Stadium is surrounded by streets with biblical names and references to Freemasonry. I think what they mean there is there's a single street with the word temple in and a few other streets that refer to the Bible and Christianity, something unheard of in London, as we all know. The Olympic Stadium is allegedly on the confluence of two ley lines. The Olympic mascots, Wenlock and Mayville, are full of Freemason and Egyptian iconography, most notably the all-seeing eye. Nick Pope, friend of the Daily Mail and former MOD UFO watcher, has allegedly been using the mainstream media as a way of warning people of possible alien contact. Apparently he's part of this whole conspiracy to fake an alien attack. Nick Pope, friend of the Daily Mail and former MOD UFO watcher, has been using the mainstream media to warn people of a possible alien contact during the games. Apparently he is part of the whole conspiracy and is getting people used to the idea of an alien attack. The conspiracy theorists have also pointed towards a UFO seen over the stadium during the opening ceremony. This blimp-shaped UFO is apparently in no way connected with the blimp that has been seen in the skies of London for the last 2 weeks by millions of Londoners, myself included. And if you're not convinced by any of that, apparently some of the slogans for the current and a few past Olympics sound a little bit, well, New World Order-y. 2000 Sydney, the slogan was, "Share the Spirit," the spirit apparently referring to the New World Order's religion. The 2000 Athens Olympics, "In the Spirit of the Games." In Beijing, it was, perhaps a little bit more frighteningly, "One World, One Dream." And the 2012 Olympics is "Inspire Regeneration." I don't know why that's connected with the New World Order. The source for a lot of this madness comes from former oil executive and current dispenser of bullshit, Ian R. Crane. Crane travels the country giving lectures on what he calls deep geopolitics. And if that sounds like a made-up subject, it's because it's largely a made-up subject. Crane claims to be the first to have jumbled up the 2012 logo to spell out the word Zion. I briefly met Crane and some of his acolytes at the CFI's Conspiracy Theory Day conference. Genuinely one of the strangest experiences of my life. There is a lot more bullshit surrounding these conspiracy theories that can be covered in such a short podcast bit. I would recommend that you check out some of Ian R. Crane's lectures, including the CFI one. They are incredibly entertaining, and let's face it, they might be right. And if there is going to be an alien invasion on the weekend, it would be nice to get a heads up if it is actually a fake one. And anyway, we all know that batshit crazy stuff like this can be incredibly entertaining. I think the most fascinating thing about the fake alien invasion conspiracy theory is that, unlike most conspiracy theories, it's actually testable. We just have to watch the closing ceremony on the weekend. It's worth noting that another prediction of Crane's actually failed to come true, unless I missed something. According to Crane in a lecture from earlier this year, the O2 Arena on August 4th was very possibly going to be the scene of a human sacrifice. The New World Order were apparently going to sacrifice the young, virgin Russian and Chinese gymnasts competing in the Olympics. Now, I have searched the internet and there were apparently no virgin sacrifices during the gymnastics. And now I have a rather interesting search history. Furthermore, surely any virgin sacrifices would have been mentioned on Olympics Tonight with Gary Lineker. Unless, of course, Gary Lineker's in on it. In which case, we're pretty much doomed. The Pod Delusion will, of course, keep you updated with any news of real or fake alien invasions. But until then, this is Blakely Nixon saying, enjoy the Olympics, because it might be the last in a free world for the Pod Delusion.
Staying with the Olympics and cast your mind back to the spectacular opening ceremony. You must remember it. There was the misappropriation of the punk movement by the establishment and the bit where that old man was forced to sing a song but he couldn't remember the words, so he just kept singing, "Nah, na na na, nah." What was that all about? But apart from this, there was also a nod to the suffragettes, and this week Jenny has recorded a piece to remind us exactly who the suffragettes were.
When faced with mass disobedience, direct action or protest, how should the police and government respond? The suffragettes represent one of the best examples of where both government and the police got it so wrong. Tired of a lack of progress towards women's suffrage, in 1903 we saw the birth of the Women's Social and Political Union, the first group whose members were known as suffragettes. The motto that quickly emerged was simple: deeds, not words. And they saw direct action as an effective way of gaining column inches. Such direct action included arson attacks. For example, in 1913 there was a notable attack on a Liberal MP's house, burning messages in acid on the grass at golf courses. The message read, "No votes, no golf," and cutting telegraph wires. Women were repeatedly promised the vote by the Liberal government and had been quietly confident when the Liberals won a landslide victory in 1906, and 400 out of the 650 MPs were in favour of votes for women. In 1907, the Women's Suffrage Bill was introduced but ran out of time. And in 1909, another bill was proposed. This was the suffrage bill that would have given almost all men the right to vote, and some women. Parliamentary disputes over the 1909 budget saw this delayed, and a new election in 1909 led to it being dropped. In 1910, another bill was put forward, the Conciliation Bill, to again grant some women the right to vote. Once again, it was passed by the Commons, but dropped when another election was called. In 1913, the same happened again, triggering more direct action, including the destruction of the London to Glasgow telephone line. Those found guilty of vandalism, arson, and other violent direct action were imprisoned and treated as ordinary criminals. The women protested further once inside as they wanted political prisoner status. This would give them recognition for the reasons behind their actions and motives for what they had done, rather than simply treating them as criminals. This was refused, and the women responded with hunger strikes, again forcing their cause into the public eye. In particular, around the 1910 election, numerous posters were produced by the suffragettes, urging those that had the vote not to vote for those behind the torture, as it was termed. Reports published in The Lancet in 1912 furthered their cause by highlighting the brutality that's being allowed against these women. Women were flung on the floor, tied down, and feeding tubes forced up their nostrils. Wardresses forced mouths open by sawing cups along the gum line. Humiliation, suffering, pneumonia, and pain were often the result. In perhaps the next act in this comedy, or tragedy of errors, the Prisoner's Temporary Discharge for Health Act was introduced in 1913. This is more commonly known by its nickname, the Cat and Mouse Act. Criticised at the time by some MPs for potentially punishing women more than once, it was passed by 296 to 43 votes. It saw women temporarily released when too frail. Emmeline Pankhurst was in and out 12 times. It afforded some women a soapbox upon their release and served to further highlight that the government did not know how to respond to the women fairly, equally, or effectively. Today we live in a state where the police exist to serve and protect all citizens, with a judiciary that has the ability to independently hear appeals about government and public organisations. We expect fair and equal treatment at the hands of our police force. However, not all suffragettes were afforded this basic expectation. If you have ever attended a protest march or demonstration, you've probably noticed forward intelligence teams, police officers tasked with intelligence gathering and surveillance. Back in 1912, Scotland Yard bought a Ross telecentric camera lens for just over £7. The government had termed the suffragettes as the biggest threat to the empire, and in contrast to today's normally overt photography, started covertly photographing them in prison yards and in public. The women in prison understandably refused to be photographed. Having suffered the indignity of force feeding and poor treatment, it is not surprising. The police responded by hiring a long lens photographer to take the shots whilst they were in the prison yards. With the aim of preventing arson attacks and women chaining themselves to railings in Parliament, the pictures and details of suffragettes were circulated among police. In 1908, Miss Nell was one such woman who managed to chain herself to railings during a cabinet meeting, ensuring her speech was heard, knowing that she could deliver much of it in the time it would take the police to unchain her. Drastic measures, perhaps, but in a society that was not prepared to listen to or represent her, what other choice did she realistically have? The police also resorted to sending officers to meetings to take notes and photographs. Women were placed on lists, followed and watched as they went about their business. Today, we allow freedom of expression, association, and political belief, rights that would not exist without historical involvement from groups like the suffragettes. Then there were also the doctored photographs. Evelyn Manesta, an inmate at Manchester Prison, came to national attention in 2003, when photos of her from prison records and a wanted poster were uncovered and released by the National Archives. The wanted poster shows a dark-haired woman looking down as she smiles, her neck swathed by a large scarf. The police photograph shows a woman smiling to herself as she realises she has won in her battle to expose the policeman hiding behind her with his arm around her neck. But this is not what you see, as the arm and all traces of him were carefully removed from the photograph that was released. On the 18th of November 1910, a day which became known in the press as Black Friday, a march to Parliament took place in response to the stalling of another bill that could have granted the right to vote for some women. Upon nearing their destination, the women were confronted by numerous police officers. It was whilst trying to pass these that the violence and disturbances began. Ada Wright was thrown to the ground by an officer, her image captured this time not by a covert police photographer, but by a press photographer. Her image appeared in the Daily Mirror the next day. The government tried to suppress the image by attempting to stop the newspaper being sold and ordered the negatives destroyed. However, they were unsuccessful and the image got out. Over 100 women were arrested, countless injured, and two lives recorded as being lost as a result of this. These two women were Mary Clark and Henrietta Williams. The latter died shortly after her release of heart failure. Miss May Billinghurst was another protester who was treated appallingly by the police. A disabled protester, she was thrown from her hand tricycle by members of the police. Later, when back on the tricycle, for a second time, her hands were held behind her back, causing her considerable pain. She was then taken down a side road and left in the middle of a potentially hostile crowd. The valves were taken from the wheels and pocketed by the officers, leaving her stranded. Thankfully, the crowd helped her. Furthermore, there are corroborated accounts of women who reported the officers grabbing their breasts as they passed through the crowds and making lewd comments as they did so, with one protester reporting that an officer grabbed her breasts hard and told her, "You've been wanting this for a long time." Foul language in the pulling of undergarments was also reported. This is perhaps not behaviour that we would associate with the treatment of British citizens in the 20th century by the police in the name of protecting the empire. Finally, in 2010, only 65.1% of the eligible population voted. We can ensure we do our part to scrutinise and keep checks on those in power by engaging and exercising hard-fought rights. And if we do decide to use protest as a means of political engagement, we should expect lessons to have been learnt from the treatment of the suffragettes and for protesters to be treated fairly under the rule of law. This is Jennifer reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, Johnny Scaramanga has been speaking to our fellow podcaster Kylie Sturgis, who has just published a new book with some of her best interviews. I think she eventually got the job. Here's Johnny with more.
Pod Delusioners, I'm proud to bring you an interview with skeptic mover, shaker and podcast maker Kylie Sturgis. Kylie is known for her appearances at conventions like DragonCon and James Randi's Amazing Meeting, as well as for her token skeptic podcast and blog. She's just released her book, The Scope of Skepticism, which is a compilation of interviews with skeptical thinkers. I talked to Kylie about skepticism, activism, and just how she landed an interview with Stephen Fry. So tell me about the book.
Well, the book began, I think, around about 2008. At least the gem of an idea began around about 2008 when I started doing transcripts of the interviews that I was doing. When I was first training as a teacher, I had a bit of spare time on my hands in the afternoons and the evenings, and I thought, well, many of my friends know another language. So I went to my local technical college, which had evening classes, and I tried to find what might be on offer for me. And one of the classes was in sign language. And I thought, oh, this is fabulous. So I started learning sign. And one of the things I started thinking about over the years was there should be more opportunities for bridges to be built between those people who have hearing difficulties or are members of the deaf community and skepticism. So when it came to getting these transcripts and putting them online so people who might not you know, clearly wouldn't listen to a podcast, but might be interested in reading what was the conversations that I had, it just seemed natural that over time I might collate them all together and turn them into a book.
So you've done hundreds of interviews. How did you decide who made it into the book?
Yeah, it was really tough narrowing it down and saying these people are the ones that I think people would enjoy reading. And I didn't want to do, you know, the superstars, as it were. You won't find, I mean, you'll hear James Randi being mentioned quite often on my podcast, and I think I've interviewed him maybe twice, but he's not in the book. He's certainly influenced many people in the book. For me, I think some of the more interesting people in skepticism and rationalism and atheism are those people who might not normally be seen on the stage, who might be in the audience or are contributing behind the scenes.
What are some of the highlights that people can expect to read?
Well, most people, when they open the book, and friends who have I've given the book to or have brought the book say to me, oh, it's Tim Minchin first up. And Tim Minchin, Stephen Fry, yeah, okay, they're people I've interviewed, but it's the people who you might not know that really intrigue me. For example, one woman goes by the name of TikTok, and her real name is Viv Smythe, and she's an Australian activist and Australian feminist. And she was very early on the scene in terms of putting out information for atheists and information for challenging creationists online in Australia. Her guide to finally a Feminism 101 blog is just fascinating. And I think for people, especially now considering the kind of milieu that's going on in skepticism, the sort of questions that are going on about how we treat each other in terms of gender and behaviour, you know, at conferences and certainly online, Viv has some wonderful advice in the discussion that I had with her. There's also Jennifer Wilette, who talks about the chilly climate in a similar fashion, about how to encourage women within skepticism, how to encourage minorities. Desiree Schell, who's an activist online in Canada, in the real world as well. She is a union activist, so she has lots of advice in terms of how to become the kind of skeptic who makes a measurable change in the world, and I think that's something that often people don't think about.
Thank you so much, Kylie.
Oh, no.
It's been great.
No, thank you for contacting me. It's wonderful to talk about this, and I'm really proud of the fact that the podcast Pod Delusion is doing so well. It's a great example of crowdsourcing, and to be able to be a part of it is also a great honour. That we should see more people taking part in the Pod Delusion. You know, let's encourage podcasting wherever we are.
Yeah, if you're listening to this, record something now.
Yes, now. Get to it.
The Scope of Skepticism by Kylie Sturgis is available now from lulu.com. Links to where you can hear her podcasts and read her interviews are on the Pod Delusion website. This is Johnny Scaramanga for the Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and all that sort of thing. Also on our website, you can make a one-off donation or subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. So if you have enjoyed the show, please do subscribe and donate so we can keep doing this week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. And mark in your diaries now, September the 15th. In the evening of September the 15th, we're doing a big Pod Delusion birthday event at Conway Hall in London. So stay tuned for more information on that. And if you're listening on the day of release, or on a Saturday, or even the Sunday during the day, get on up to Edinburgh, where our deputy editor Liz Luckendorf will be giving a talk on secular history on Skeptics on the Fringe. You can find links to find out more on poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Corey Hazelhurst, Blakely Nixon, Jenny Dutton, Johnny Scaramanga, and me, James O'Malley. The Sketch in a Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
join us here outside Troy and we're set for another great battle. In the commentator's box you have Invidalian and me, Gary Linicus.
The Greeks looked set to take it all yesterday, but with the Trojans struggling in second place.
It's the final heat now, with the winner of this one set to take home the gold.
And Helen?
Yes, her too. And it's the Greek favourite leading from the front. Achilles really showing his class.
That'll teach him to wear a short toga.
His class.
Oh, right, yeah. Anyway, whatever he's wearing, you can't deny this Olympian hero as he charges towards the city walls. And oh no, he's down.
And that's a surprise upset in his 9-year bout. A lucky arrow from the Trojan defence has impaled Achilles in his heel and brought the champ down. Could be all over for Greece now.
But wait, what's this? Achilles' trainer, Placebus, has gone on to assist him, and he's sticking some new Kinesio tape across the wound.
And Achilles is up again. Placebus has been accused of doing nothing all season, then suddenly the cheeky little Greek has given Achilles some get up and go.
And whilst Achilles continues his charge, Placebus is revelling in his newfound triumph. He's gone over to the wooden horse that was used for the opening ceremony and
he's taping the legs up. The previously splintered hooves now looking smashing, with a variety of coloured tapes running up all four legs of this equine colossus.
Covering the horse's legs in bandages. Ingenious. What's that called?
A dressage, I believe. And now the Greeks are dancing as Troy falls and victory is in the air.
Do you know, I bet in 2,500 years they'll commemorate all this with sporting feats and horses dancing with bandages on their legs.
You're a dreamer, Invidalian. There's as much chance of that happening as this mighty Greek superpower being brought to financial ruin.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, yeah. It must be the Uzo talking.